Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
The main thing that jumps out is that we raised our pork export forecast for 2023 by 300 million pounds.
Looking at the latest pork export projections, World Ag Outlook Board Chairman Dr. Mark Jekanowski.
And this just reflects some strength in recent data. U.S. pork exports have been strong, and it's been to a number of markets. There's not any single country or region that seems to be driving that demand. It's just that we've been shipping more pork recently, and we expect that strength to continue into 2024. So we raised our 2024 pork export forecast by 500 million pounds. Pork export forecast for 2023 currently at 6.8 million pounds, and roughly the same for 2024, up just fractionally up by about 17 million pounds next year.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Administrations from Democrat to Republican and Republican to Democrat, we toggle back and forth between these interpretations of what the statutes actually mean.
Wyoming Representative Harriet Hageman.
The definition of the navigable waters of the U.S. rule, I think that that's a perfect example of how that happens. Under Trump and under previous administrations, and obviously my interpretation of the Clean Water Act is quite narrow in the sense of what was intended by Congress. Congress used the word navigable waters of the United States for a reason. But over the last 30 years, especially, the courts have really written the word navigable out of the statute. And then what you have with an Obama administration, a Clinton administration, or a Biden administration, because they use things like the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, and the various other statutes to for land grabs. The Endangered Species Act is another example. FLIPMA is another example. They use these statutes not for the purpose that they were intended, but for the purpose of controlling our lives and restricting our ability to use our own private property.
Well, with the Supreme Court ruling against the EPA, where do we go?
Well, I think that we go back to the words of the statute. And I am hoping that the EPA and the Corps of Engineers will finally get the message that that statute means what it says and says what it means. Now, so many people want to say, oh, now we're going to have dirty water and they're going to destroy our waterways and blah, 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 blah. That's not the case. What the point of the Clean Water Act was is that federal jurisdiction should be limited and confined. The states still have jurisdiction, and every state in the nation has a Department of Environmental Quality. It might go by a different name. Maybe it's the Department of Natural Resources. But in Wyoming, it's the Department of Environmental Quality. And we have a water quality division. And it will go back to the states in terms of overseeing those smaller streams. In addition to which, it's always interesting to me that people really believe that the federal government is out there managing and dictating how we do things. They do that through litigation, and they do that through prosecuting and persecuting landowners. But in reality, it is the states that manage our waterways right now and our water resources. In Wyoming, in terms of water quantity, it's the Wyoming State Engineer's Office and Board of Control. Water quality, again, is the Department of Environmental Quality.
In many instances, Washington just doesn't get it.
I noticed that in my committee work with working with folks from the other side. They don't understand, or they have up to this point, at least they feigned not to understand, that wildlife is managed, again, by state agencies. I'll use Wyoming, the Wyoming Game and Fish Department. So even for endangered or threatened species, we don't have a bunch of federal employees running around Wyoming and protecting our grizzly bears or our wolves or any other. Well, wolves aren't listed anymore, but the grizzly bears are. It is the Wyoming Game and Fish Department. And as an example of what I mean by that, Wyoming has spent $59 million recovering the grizzly bear population. The federal government has spent $100,000. Yet it's the federal government and the Fish and Wildlife Service that refuses to delist the grizzly bear, despite the fact that we met our recovery goals almost a quarter century ago. So here we are 25 years later, we have double the population of grizzly bears that was included in that recovery plan, and we can't delist because the environmental groups, again, use the Endangered Species Act to control activities on private land. So, yeah, I think it's very clear that people back here in Washington, D.C. do not understand how we manage water, how we manage wildlife, how we manage a lot of these resources, yet they're the ones that are making the decisions. And it's been very challenging to our producers, to our oil and gas developers, to our coal miners, to our Department of Transportation, to so many organizations, private and public, because Washington, D.C. is where the rules are made, but they're enforced out at an area where the folks back here, they don't understand Wyoming.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Certainly the markets have recovered in really strong form from the COVID-19 pandemic.
Tanner Beamer with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
That's kind of bittersweet in a lot of ways. A lot of that has been drought-fueled liquidation that has resulted in some of the scarcity that you're seeing in the cattle supplies, which has helped inflate some of the prices for fat cattle, calves, feeder cattle, and the like. Certainly a welcome development for producers who have been struggling to maintain profitability for a number of years, but we're still facing really high interest rates, really high input costs. Basis is kind of out of whack in some parts of the country. So there's certainly challenges remaining for cattle producers, but all in all, a much more favorable marketing environment than we've seen in the past couple of years. Our goal now at this point is to make sure that Congress or the agencies don't do anything that could upend that significant progress that we've seen and allow the market to reach prices that we haven't seen in some cases ever, and in other cases certainly for several decades.
But it's important to remember how all this started.
I like to always go back to the Holcomb fire in 2019, because I think that kind of sets where the fundamentals were at that particular moment in time, right? The COVID-19 pandemic was certainly orders of magnitude worse, but we were already in a pretty dangerous position just by nature of the cattle cycle when that Holcomb fire hit in August of 2019, right? You saw very, very high supplies of market-ready cattle, and not a whole lot of hooks available to process them. And then the Holcomb fire hits, and you see this microcosm of what we didn't know at the time, but was going to be the COVID-19 pandemic, right? At the time, we were processing at capacity, somewhere between 650 and 660,000 head of cattle per week. And so when you took 6% of that shackle space offline in the Holcomb fire, or 40% of that shackle space offline during the COVID-19 pandemic, that took an already unfavorable part of the cattle cycle for cattle producers and magnified it tenfold and made that situation untenable to the point where you did see meteoric box beef prices at a time when cattle producers were losing money left and right. Thankfully, we've recovered from that somewhat in the last several months. There's still definitely some progress that can be made, but by and large, you know, that supply-demand imbalance has rectified itself. Again, just sort of by nature of the cattle market figuring itself out and bringing itself back into equilibrium. We don't have the same high supplies of cattle that we did 2 years ago. As a matter of fact, we're looking at a position where we are seeing cattle as more of a scarce resource. We're processing today between 600 and 610,000 head of cattle as opposed to 660,000 a couple years ago. So we're not processing at full capacity right now. And so when you see some of these minor plant disruptions come up, they don't have the same ripple effect throughout the entire industry as once they did. And as a result, you're seeing fat cattle prices climb to places that we've never seen them before. We just set a spot live cattle futures contract price record a couple weeks ago, and that I think was somewhere in the ballpark of $172 a hundredweight, and the cash market is even incredibly strong for fats as well. So we're in a fundamentally a different place than we were a couple years ago, and ultimately that cycle is going to come back. We're going to hit another tipping point where you might see some of that processing capacity fall offline again, just as a result of fewer cattle moving through the system. And then the pendulum will start to swing back the other way again, as is the nature of the long-term cattle cycle. But for right now, producers are experiencing some pretty good prices that we're hoping can help them weather some of the storms that will lie ahead in 3, 5, 7 years.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
So 85% of the dollars go to nutrition programming, SNAP.
Mark Molinaro is a representative from upstate New York and is a new member of the House Ag Committee, talking about nutrition programs in the Farm Bill.
I think we took an important step during the debt ceiling conversation, which was to sort of reaffirm that we want SNAP to be a supportive benefit, right? We want folks to get access to quality nutrition while also bettering themselves and getting back into the workforce, et cetera, and doing it in a way that's compassionate to those who are most vulnerable. I grew up on food stamps. It was of benefit to my mother to get herself back on her feet, and were it not for food stamps and supportive lunch at school, we would have been absent that benefit. It was really necessary and helpful to my mom to get back to a level of independence. for the last 12 years prior to coming to Congress, I was a county executive in New York. And what that means is I had to administer the social services for 300,000 county residents. I have seen what states like New York and Illinois and California have done with food stamps. They've become very good at processing checks, but not so good at supporting people. And they've created, using federal dollars, they take federal taxpayer money, it's not the government money, government's money, it's the taxpayer's money, and they use it to support their infrastructure, their government infrastructure, their bureaucracy. And they've created a system, SNAP, social services, etc., that dehumanizes people. When these programs like SNAP are meant to help people get to a level of independence, both food independence and security and economic independence and security, I'm focused on making sure that the dollars we dedicate to SNAP are effectively used, that we're changing the method from processing checks to truly helping people. And I think that that's an important next step, sort of refocusing the mission statement of SNAP as a benefit, which isn't to at all undermine its purpose. We have to help the most vulnerable. But we need to do it in a way that helps people achieve the independence they seek for themselves. And that's what we're focused on.
A big part of this argument is one side thinking the other doesn't care. But Molinaro says,
we can't legislate love, but if we start from the place of love, we can legislate in order to achieve it. And I think that that's a really, you described it better than I could. But I would say to you that we have now a system of social services that makes people feel worth less. And when we can have a system that is compassionate and caring to help people understand the value that they have, not only for themselves, but for community and society. And so if we use the tools like SNAP and other social service benefits, we shouldn't hollow them out. We should make them more caring, more compassionate, and more collaborative to help people get the support that they need. My mom was undiagnosed with depression during that time that she lived. We lived on food stamps. Had there been the wraparound support, the additional mental health supports that states have today, but they operate in silos, she would have been diagnosed earlier, and perhaps she would have had a more independent life. She would have had more success. If we can identify those things using the tools we have, instead of just cutting the check, but rather creating the compassion and the collaboration necessary, we can truly help people. And those most vulnerable deserve a government that cares about them and respects them and helps them get to the level of independence they seek for themselves. Not the independence I determine for you, but the level of independence you can achieve for yourself. And that reestablishes your wealth, your self-worth, and the value, and we reassert a value, and the value we have for every individual life.
Representative Mark Molinaro, member of the House Ag Committee. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
China is a legitimate long-term threat to our country.
He's a member of the House Ag Committee, of the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, and a select committee on China. Dusty Johnson, representative from South Dakota.
They have been trying to knock us down for about 20 years, and we've been sleepwalking through it. That being said, we really need a fair amount of leadership and nuance. We just cannot allow the voices that are least reasonable to guide the day. And here's what I mean by that. I mean, 60% of South Dakota soybeans are sold overseas. The overwhelming majority of them go to China. And so it's fine to say, oh, the Chinese are our enemy, we're not dealing with them anymore. And there are clearly ways in which we should be willing to strategically decouple from the Chinese Communist Party. But we also need to be honest with the fact that there are types of trade that can benefit the Chinese people. And Americans, we need to be smart enough to be able to tell what's good trade and what's trade that's more problematic.
And what about using the World Trade Organization? Does it still have a place?
I'm a believer in the rules-based system. You know, when the United States challenges China in the WTO, we have never lost. China has a terrible track record in front of the WTO because they don't do a very good job following the rules. And so if we are willing to push the envelope a little bit, we know that we can have findings from the WTO that China's not playing straight, they're not doing right. That's going to give us more leverage. And again, I don't have a problem if China's buying our soybeans and if we're buying cheap T-shirts from them. But I do think it's a big problem if there are critically important minerals or supplies or medical equipment that we can only get from one country in the world. We need to be willing to diversify our supply chains a little bit.
He's also been working on some legislation known as the SAVE Act.
Europe just loves to label things, and then they act like they own the label. The most famous one, most people understand that champagne, in America we got to call it sparkling wine. If it doesn't come from the Champagne region of France, that word is off limits to the rest of us. And they just create more of these all the time. I mean, oh, you can't call this cheese that. You can't call this meat that. And the reality is that this is just protectionism. This is just Europe trying to protect their goods at the expense. They don't want to be able to open up their markets. They don't want other markets to be able to be open up to American products, which in many cases are better than the European products anyway. My bill, the SAVE Act, which we're hoping to get included in the Farm Bill, would just make it clear that there are going to be a list of things. I mean, Europe does not get to decide what America calls our food products, and that we are going to instruct the USTR, the U.S. Trade Representative, to go make sure that we negotiate better deals with Europe with regard to these place names.
As a member of the House Ag Committee, he's working to write a new farm bill to replace the existing bill, which expires in September.
We are going to get a farm bill. You know, it has been, frankly, there have been a lot of other things going on in Washington, D.C., so we are, I think, getting to a point now where we're beginning to build up some momentum behind a farm bill. We had a hearing today. I'm chairman of the subcommittee that oversees rural development, among other things. We had a great hearing today with some real specific examples about what we need to do in that rural development title to better invest in rural communities. And so we're getting the kind of specific feedback from broader America that I think is going to help us bring this farm bill into focus. But we don't have a lot of time. We do need, I think, to shift into a higher gear and be prepared to get this thing done in the next few months.
South Dakota Representative Dusty Johnson. I'm Tony St. James. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
So right to repair is like it sounds. It's the ability to repair your own equipment. In order to do that, you have to have the tools necessary to get your equipment up and running.
Emily Buckman is Director of Government Affairs for the American Farm Bureau Federation.
Over the last several years, American Farm Bureau, at the direction of our member farmers and ranchers, have been having conversations with manufacturers to address the issue of right to repair. Since January, we have entered into 5 agreements with 5 different manufacturers. Most recently, this week, we just entered into a memorandum of understanding with Kloss America.
So the right to repair is really in a different time than maybe 50 years ago. Because now with computers and other types of equipment, it can be a challenge. And Buckman acknowledges that.
So you're correct. Ag equipment has certainly become more technologically advanced. No longer do you just have a wrench and all of a sudden you can fix your equipment.